Okay, let's unpack this. We are zeroed in today on a mental terrain that's, well, it's far more challenging than the Roaring
Oh,
Forties.
absolutely. We're talking about the human mind pushed to its absolute breaking point.
And the crucible for this is the Golden Globe Race.
Right. It's the longest continuous sporting event in the world. And it's really an exercise in sailing history. You're
Yeah.
sailing single-handed, nonstop, around the world.
But with a huge catch.
A huge catch.
Right.
You're using only technology that was available in 1968. So that means no satellite routing, no modern GPS, except for, a basic position check from the race office.
And you're getting your weather how?
Weather forecasts come in over HF radio,
Mm-hmm.
which means you have to listen to this scratchy signal, manually write it all down, and
Yeah.
then plot it on your paper charts. It's intense.
But we aren't here for the technical manuals today, are we? This deep dive is really customized for you, the GGR 2026 hopeful. Our mission is to basically provide a psychological roadmap. We're channeling insights from performance psychology experts who've really mapped out the stress neurology, the coping resources, and the emotional regulation strategies of these solo circumnavigators.
Think of it like this. You have to prepare your internal environment just as rigorously as you prepare your boat's hull. We're moving beyond just physical endurance and focusing on three really critical dimensions of mental readiness.
Okay, what are they?
It's commitment, cognitive resource management, and then crisis application. The core truth, the thing to remember, is that self-knowledge is your most critical survival tool when you are completely and utterly isolated.
All right, let's get straight into it. So, part one, the pre-race conditioning, building the mental hull.
So the preparation phase, which can last for years, it's deceptively dangerous from a psychological standpoint.
How so? Because you'd think all that time would make you stronger.
It can, but the commitment required has to be absolute, just 100%. And it has to be rooted in some ruthless self-assessment.
Yeah, the sources we analyzed are so stark about the environment. The one that really stands out is the ocean is not a therapist.
That's the one. It is not the place to go to heal and escape any of your issues. If you carry unresolved personal baggage or psychological issues out onto the sea,
He's going to come back to bite you.
oh, the isolation combined with the chronic fatigue will just amplify it until it's completely inescapable. That's the crux of this intense internal experiment.
Because when the horizon is just 360 degrees of water and you are literally trapped on a tiny boat for months on end.
Your only constant companion is your own brain. Your own cognitive processing. Any avoidance behavior, any emotional issue you thought you left behind on the dock will be thrust right back into your face with the intensity of a southern ocean storm.
So it's a clarifying mirror, but a brutal one.
Extremely brutal.
And what about the danger in the commitment itself? I'm talking about sunk cost blindness. A GGR campaign can consume years of a sailor's life, their entire savings.
All their emotional capital from their family, it's a massive investment. And that investment, that sunk cost, is probably the single greatest psychological pitfall before you even get to the start line.
Because you've put so much in.
You spend so much time, so much money, so much energy on this one goal that you can become blind to what the voyage actually is. The
Right.
focus shifts too heavily onto the romanticism of it all.
The allure of the ultimate adventure, the big finish line party.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The spectacle, but the reality check is absolutely mandatory.
And that reality is, well, it's not glamorous. We're talking about terrifying nights at sea, agonizing days where you're just becalmed, going nowhere.
The mental anguish of a mechanical failure in the middle of nowhere, the constant physical discomfort.
Saltwater rashes, the relentless smell of the boat, just the lack of basic cleanliness.
All of it. So the real question for a prospective sailor is, how do you move past that romantic ideal to fully, truly absorb that grim reality?
Because you have to want that part too.
You have to. And this transition, this mental shift, forms the foundation of one of the primary emotion regulation strategies we talk about. It's called situation modification.
Okay, break that down.
It's a bit of a mouthful, but the concept is simple. It means taking actions before an emotional event happens to influence the situation itself.
So you're trying to head off the negative emotions at the pass.
Precisely. And the most powerful form of situation modification in this context is that comprehensive reality check. You have to actively, deliberately consider the non-glamorous reality
Yeah.
and confirm that your desire to do this race is strong enough to embrace the misery, not just the glory.
So it's not just about managing emotions once they show up. It's about modifying the input to reduce the chances of those destructive emotions taking hold in the first place.
That's it. You're building a psychological seawall before the storm even forms.
Does this apply to the goal structure itself? I mean, just having the goal of finishing isn't enough, is it?
That's a great point. It's absolutely crucial. The need for a North Star, a clear set goal and destination, is paramount. We've seen documented cases of very experienced sailors who, during a particularly tough trip, started to question their purpose for the first time.
And what happened?
The lack of a clear, defined objective caused this immense mental spinning, a near breakdown at sea. The ocean is just. It is precisely the wrong place for existential abstraction.
So what did he do? How did he pull himself out of it?
He reached a breaking point. And then he realized that simply setting a firm, immediate goal, it could be as simple as fixing a specific broken part or just reaching the next line of longitude that provided the purpose he was missing.
So the goal gives you a trajectory for action.
It does. It becomes a key coping resource when everything else feels completely overwhelming. That purpose grounds you. It provides a context for all the immense hardship.
Right. Without that why, every broken winch, every day of frustratingly light winds just feels meaningless.
And that feeling of meaninglessness is a direct line to hopelessness and depression.
Okay, let's shift to the more practical side of this pre-race conditioning. The big one is isolation. It's the constant. You can't really simulate a full circumnavigation, but how do you train for the mental toll of just sheer continuous solitude?
The best we can suggest is isolation simulation. Solo camping trips, for instance.
Really? Camping?
Think about it. You're alone for days, maybe even a week or two. You're managing all your basic tasks, cooking, maintenance, navigating, without any external distraction or social interaction.
Mm.
It's the closest land-based training you can get.
And what does that do for you? What are you looking for?
It allows you to assess how you actually handle being alone. Do you start pacing? Do you become irritable? Or can you actually manage that internal quiet? Can you sit with yourself?
Because the goal isn't to fight the isolation.
Right? No, fighting it is completely counterproductive. It just drains your precious energy. The solution, as so many successful solo sailors have discovered, is immersion.
You have to lean into it.
You have to embrace the quiet. You have to deliberately try to live in the present moment and just observe your surroundings. The light on the water, the shapes of the waves, the dolphins that swim by.
And this immersion, this acceptance, that's what builds self-efficacy.
It's critical for it. Self-efficacy is just the core belief that you will rise to the occasion when things inevitably turn ugly. When fear starts to creep in during a storm, you need mental ammunition to fight back.
And that ammunition comes from past experiences, doesn't it? That time you handled a knockdown, or when you had to fix a complex problem in really heavy seas.
Precisely. Those prior successes, those real deal, scary situations you've survived, they become your reference points. They allow you to mentally counter the incoming fear with empirical evidence. You can say to yourself, I handled that one, so I can handle this one.
Without those internal data points, your confidence is just, it's purely theoretical.
And theory doesn't help much when you're facing a 50-foot wave.
This brings us right to the connection between technical preparation and psychological armor. In the GGR, where you're forced back to 1968 technology, your preparation has to be, well, maniacal.
It's a high-level application of that same strategy we mentioned, situation modification. The thorough checks of your hull integrity, the rigging, complying with that massive, extensive safety inspection process.
Those aren't just boxes to tick.
Not at all. They are psychological defenses. The confidence you get from knowing your boat is in the absolute best possible state it can be in keeps your baseline anxieties significantly lower.
And we talked about preparing for storms. That requires planning for multiple contingencies, right? Not just one plan.
Yes. Instead of just sitting there and worrying about a potential 70-knot gale, you channel that nervous energy into productive preparation. You develop a plan A.
Which might be running off under a storm job.
Exactly. And a plan B, maybe heaving to with a drogue. Plan C could be lying a hull with minimal sail.
Yeah.
And then plan D, the last resort, is deploying the parachute sea anchor.
By having these multiple pre-thought out actionable steps,
you focus your energy on positive action, not on catastrophic rumination. The fear is significantly dampened because you have agency. You have a pathway to follow. You're not just a victim of the weather.
Let's push on the cognitive load required by the GGR rules. This seems immense. Because you're denied modern electronic aids like GPS routing and chart plotters, the sailor has to constantly engage their cognitive resources.
The level of sustained cognitive load is what makes this race so unique in modern sailing. It's relentless. You're using a sextant and a watch to confirm your position, which requires precise calculation and meticulous logging.
And then there's the weather.
For weather, you're listening to those scratchy HF radio signals, you're recording complex data, the zone, the time, the pressure, the wind, and then you have to manually plot all those weather systems onto your paper charts. And you're not just plotting today's weather, you're analyzing how it's evolved over days to predict what's coming.
That is just continuous problem solving. It's filling in boxes, connecting data points, and it must constantly drain your mental resources.
It does. But even with these extreme restrictions, there is one small technological relief that provides a massive, massive psychological benefit.
The autopilot.
The humble autopilot. Usually it's connected to an electronic wind vane, and it is absolutely crucial for preserving your energy.
Because it never gets tired, never gets bored.
That's the key phrase. Unlike a human sailor, it has no emotions. We inevitably experience frustration, annoyance, fatigue, especially when you're steering manually in light, strange, or unstable winds. It's maddening.
And the autopilot just takes that whole frustrating human element out of the equation.
Completely. And that frees you up to rest or focus on navigation or do maintenance. It's a major essential boost to your cognitive resource conservation.
But I have to ask, isn't relying on the autopilot too much a potential psychological crutch? Doesn't it rob you of essential steering practice, which is a core part of that self-efficacy we just discussed?
That's a really important point. It's all about balance. You absolutely must maintain your manual skills, your celestial navigation, your hand steering, because the autopilot can, and often does, fail.
So you have to be ready to take over.
At any moment.
Yeah.
However, the psychological benefit of guaranteed rest and a moment of guaranteed non-frustration steering, that outweighs the potential for skill atrophy. The GGR is a marathon of conservation.
You're conserving energy for when you absolutely need it.
For when the weather is monstrous or the boat is broken. The autopilot conserves the energy you would otherwise waste on mundane, frustrating tasks. In that sense, it's a tool for emotional stability.
Okay, so once the start gun fires, the sailor is immediately immersed in what you call the emotional ocean. And isolation is the most profound challenge. You're thousands of miles from land, the horizon is 360 degrees of water, and you are trapped in what one sailor called an impossible situation.
Right. And as we've established, fighting that isolation is futile. It doesn't work. The sailors who successfully complete this race, they learn to fully immerse themselves in it. They listen to the quiet. They find this deep sense of communion with the ocean and the planet.
They talk about seeing real color, real light, a depth of sensory experience they just missed when they were ashore.
It becomes this internal contemplative existence. It's the gift of time. Time for reflection, time to observe the world without the constant chaos and noise of modern society.
Yeah, one successful circumnavigator described realizing that the purity of the experience itself, that connection with his boat and the planet, was actually more important than any competition or legacy.
And that realization is a powerful shift. It helps reframe the goal from, say, competitive achievement to something more like existential survival and appreciation.
But this internal world is incredibly volatile.
Highly volatile. Solitary conditions intensify emotional fluctuation. It creates what you could call a bipolar landscape. Moods can swing violently between intense enthusiasm and cheerfulness to crushing sadness, anxiety, and just profound boredom.
These emotional swings aren't just moods. They're intense emotional states, magnified by being alone. And the sources identify two states that are particularly pervasive out there: anxiety and boredom.
And it's important, if you're a GGR sailor, to understand the components of anxiety. It's not just one single feeling. It's split into two parts: cognitive anxiety and somatic anxiety.
So cognitive anxiety is the worrying part, the thoughts.
It's the worrying thoughts, the mental gymnastics about your performance, potential boat malfunctions, or distress over your family and life back on shore. It's the what-if game.
And somatic anxiety is the physical manifestation of those thoughts.
Correct. That's the perception of physiological arousal. So the nervous tension, the elevated heart rate, the sweaty palms, the tightness in your chest. These two components, the internal worry and the physical arousal, they conspire to limit your performance and sap your enjoyment, even during the nice, calm periods of good weather.
And the cognitive load of the GGR makes a sailor especially vulnerable to the cognitive form, I'd imagine.
Very much so. Your brain is already working overtime.
And the counterpoint to anxiety, which often arrives when boat is running smoothly or you're becalmed, is the vast pervasive threat of boredom.
And boredom is a really serious cognitive trap.
Because it encourages rumination.
Exactly. When you have these vast stretches of doing nothing time, your mind, which is starved of external input, it turns inward. And it often focuses on worries.
This is why having intentional activities is so important.
It's essential. Reading, writing, drawing, simple maintenance routines, even baking bread. These activities have to be scheduled and treated as critical components of your psychological provisioning. They are designed specifically to manage that mental quiet.
So this leads us directly into this vicious feedback loop, the one involving mental fatigue, your emotional state, and your decision making.
It's a nasty one. The continuous cognitive engagement navigating, weather plotting maintenance, coupled with a chronic lack of sleep, leads inexorably to mental fatigue.
And this fatigue is the critical bottleneck.
It is, because mental fatigue severely impairs your emotion regulation. When you are exhausted, your ability to rationally process emotions, to choose the right regulation strategy, or to suppress unproductive thought patterns, it just collapses.
And what's fascinating is how your affective state, your immediate mood or emotion, directly impacts how you process information. And that can have life or death consequences.
Absolutely. So if a sailor is in a relatively good, calm state, they tend to adopt what's called heuristic processing.
Meaning they rely on shortcuts.
Right. They rely on their prior knowledge, their established plans, generalizations. They pay less attention to the immediate, minute details. And this is generally efficient. It works.
But the danger arises when the sailor is anxious or in a bad mood or excessively worried, which is, you know, often the case during a crisis.
Correct. In that anxious state, the brain switches. It adopts systematic processing. And when this happens, the sailor places enormous weight and attention on the current, immediate details and situations.
To the exclusion of their prior knowledge.
Often to the exclusion of crucial prior knowledge or their own expertise.
Can you give us a concrete GGR example of this cognitive trap? How does systematic processing actually hurt a sailor during a crisis?
Of course. Imagine you're caught in a sudden, violent squall. The waves are building quickly, the wind is shifting all over the place, you're anxious, you're fatigued. You enter systematic processing.
Okay.
So instead of trusting the boat preparation that you spent 3 years perfecting or hauling your Plan B storm strategy that you practiced, you focus intensely on one immediate, terrifying detail.
Like the sound of one big wave hitting the hull.
Or the immediate reading on the wind gauge spiking to 60 knots. You over-index on that immediate threat.
And you forget the bigger picture.
Precisely. You might forget the fundamental prepared knowledge, for example, that your boat is actually designed to handle this, or that your plan said you should have deployed the drogue an hour ago. That reliance on current anxiety-inducing details while ignoring the broader context or your prepared expertise is highly problematic. And it just drains the cognitive resources you desperately need for rational action.
So this sets the stage for the core vicious cycle, the one we warn all entrants about, which is the more I try to control my emotions, the more energy I use, which will make it even harder to regulate them and think straight.
That's the trap. That constant, effortful attempt to control your emotions, especially when you're sleep deprived, it just drains your limited cognitive reserves. This cascading failure fatigue leading to impaired regulation, leading to poor information processing, that's what can ultimately pave the way toward a catastrophic mental breakdown.
The cautionary tale of Donald Crowhurst.
Those tragic example. His mind simply ran out of gas trying to fight itself.
So understanding those cognitive traps is step one. But step two is deploying active, deliberate psychological strategies when the crisis hits. When that catastrophic feeling arrives, we need to move from just understanding to active application of these performance psychology tools.
Right. And when a crisis happens, the very first thing a sailor must do is differentiate between the primary and the secondary emotional responses.
Okay.
The primary response is that raw, immediate emotional shock. Seeing a bent mast after a collapse and just breaking down in tears, as one GGR sailor recounted, it's uncontrollable and it's immediate.
But the secondary response is where you can exert control.
That's right. This is the self-regulatory effort you need to cope with that initial raw feeling. It's about shifting your focus from emotional shock to effective action.
So how does a sailor actively engage that shift? How do you do it in the moment?
Well, once the preparatory strategy situation modification is no longer possible, you know, the damage is done, the sailor turns to two other key strategies. The first, is attentional deployment.
That sounds incredibly complex to pull off in a life-threatening situation. How can you deploy your attention away from a bent mast or a huge hole in your sail?
It requires intense mental discipline, and it has to be practiced. If the situation is just overwhelmingly difficult or emotionally toxic, say the boat is severely compromised in heavy weather, you have to intentionally direct your attention away from the immediate emotional trigger.
So you acknowledge the damage, but you don't dwell on it.
You acknowledge it, but you strictly focus on the immediate solvable physical tasks.
For example, instead of just staring at the ruined mast and despairing, the sailor focuses solely on, say, lashing down the remaining rigging or meticulously preparing the emergency inventory.
Exactly. You narrow your focus to the functional step-by-step process required to stabilize the vessel. This helps you avoid the full primary emotional impact, that overwhelming sense of hopelessness, and it conserves crucial mental energy. It allows for a calmer, less cognitively burdened approach to the actual repair later on.
And the second strategy is response modulation.
Right, which is intentionally manipulating the physical or experiential expression of your emotions.
This can take a few different forms, I'd imagine.
It does. On the one hand, it can be a physiological release. Screaming, shouting, even punching a soft cushion in the cockpit is a recognized form of tension release. It's a way to modulate the intensity of the stress response. Get it out of your system.
And on the other hand, it's about proactive physiological control.
Yes. This is where deliberate breathing techniques, grounding exercises, or regular meditative practices come in. These are intended to alter your physiological state, slowing your heart rate, reducing that somatic anxiety response, which then feeds back positively into reducing your cognitive anxiety.
And the key is, you have to practice these during the calm times.
You practice them during the lulls so they become automatic during the chaos.
Yeah.
You don't want to be trying to remember how to do a box breathing exercise for the first time in a 70-knot squall.
Okay, when dealing with the immense existential fear of a severe threat, like an approaching hurricane force low, that psychological shift has to be instantaneous. How do you convert sheer anxiety into productive, positive action?
The energy that would be wasted on just sitting there and worrying has to be surgically shifted toward preparation. If you spend 3 hours worrying about the worst case scenario, you've just depleted 3 hours of energy you could have spent implementing your plan A, B, C, or D.
So the creation and implementation of those comprehensive escalating contingency plans, that's not just good seamanship, it's a fear management technique.
Precisely. By moving your focus to actionable steps, deploying a drogue, securing all the hatches, stripping the deck of anything that could break loose, you regain a sense of control and agency over the situation. Feeling prepared, even for the worst, significantly dampens the fear because you have a pathway to follow instead of just freezing up.
One of the most terrifying places psychologically has to be the Southern Ocean, where waves can reach 50 feet. The sources mention the helicopter view visualization technique to manage this high-speed, adrenaline-spiking environment.
This is a performance psychology technique specifically designed to break that immediate adrenaline cycle caused by the proximity of the threat. When you're surfing at high speed down a massive wave face, the perceived danger is just. It's overwhelming.
But can a sailor truly achieve this visualization when they're physically exhausted and fighting the wheel? Doesn't the sheer physicality make this technique seem a bit too abstract?
It does require practice, but it works precisely because the body is overwhelmed. The sailor intentionally shifts their mental perspective to visualize the scene from high above, from cloud level, as if you're viewing your own boat from a safe distance in a helicopter.
Okay, so you're mentally pulling yourself out of the cockpit.
You are. And from this vantage point, you can objectively confirm that the boat is stable, that the waves, while massive, are organized, and importantly, that there are no immediate obstacles like icebergs or shipping containers.
And the psychological benefit is what? Reducing your heart rate.
Exactly. By viewing the scenario as an objective observer rather than an immediate, terrified participant, the brain reduces the panic response. It allows the sailor to rest, even if it's just for a few hours, before the next big wave cycle begins.
Mental toughness, though, has to apply not just to these acute crises, but to chronic endurance. The anecdote from Mark Slatz during his ocean rowing venture perfectly illustrates this mind-body fight. He experienced this incredible physical pain, especially after taking a short break.
He did. And what he found was that the body's resistance, the pain, it stopped after only about 10 minutes of resuming the painful action of rowing.
Which is amazing.
It is. The body is an incredible machine, capable of immense feats, but it sends these false signals of failure. The mind game is absolutely key here. When the body is screaming no more, The mind has to possess the internal resource to keep driving.
So it's a psychological reframing, shifting the goal from external competition to self-achievement.
Proving to yourself internally that you can overcome the pain signals and maintain continuous motion.
Sleep deprivation is a continuous problem you just can't eliminate, especially during changeable weather or squally periods. And lack of sleep warps reality. The brain plays tricks, right?
It does. Auditory hallucinations are common, like hearing a distant engine when nothing is there, or seeing flashing lights on the horizon.
Since you can't guarantee 8 hours of sleep, the defense is to aim for a perpetual tired state.
A state where you can maximize the advantage of any short lull in the weather. And to facilitate those critical 20 or 45 minute naps, your safety tools function as a vital mental security blanket.
That mental assurance is crucial for allowing the brain to actually switch off.
Knowing your systems are active, the AIS transceiver, the radar reflector, strong navigation lights, even having a laser pointer ready to target a ship's bridge if they won't answer the VHF, that provides the assurance that you will get a wake-up call if collision danger arises. That basic guarantee allows a sailor to achieve the depth of relaxation needed to make short sleep actually restorative.
What about the uncontrollable, low-probability fears? Hitting a whale or being struck by a rogue wave, these can be paralyzing. They can keep a sailor awake for hours.
For these, you have to practice what we call transposing the mind. You cannot maintain constant vigilance against a rogue wave for months on end. It's impossible. You have to stop dwelling, rationalize the impossibility of 247 watchfulness, and consciously distract your brain.
How do you practically achieve that transposition? What does it look like?
You have to flood your mind with positive, non-threatening imagery. Think about a happy place. Deeply focus on a loved one. Mentally narrate a past beautiful moonlit moment at sea. You have to actively replace the terrifying image with an image that is mentally and emotionally restorative. This is essential self-care to ensure you get the critical sleep you need to maintain cognitive function.
Okay, finally in the section, let's address major setbacks, the psychological equivalent of hitting the wall. When a sailor suffers a massive failure, like breaking a hydrofoil or suffering major mass damage, the ultimate task of finishing the race suddenly feels crushing and impossible.
This is where goal decomposition becomes essential.
Breaking it down.
Goal decomposition is the psychological mechanism for handling the unbearable. You continuously break the massive goal down into smaller and smaller achievable tasks until it is instantly manageable.
So you go from, I have to win the GGR to, I just have to finish the GGR. But if that's still too large after a catastrophe, you go even lower.
Much lower. You break it down to survive the next 12 hours, then maybe fix this one specific lashing. And if even that feels overwhelming, you go for the absolute lowest, most instantly achievable goal you can think of.
Like what?
Like eat a packet of nasty freeze-dried food, or tighten one bolt on the emergency rudder. The smallest possible forward step.
And the psychological power of achieving that micro goal is the key, isn't it?
That's everything. Every time one of those small goals is achieved, the brain releases positive chemicals, dopamine, endorphins, and that boosts your mood and your performance. It provides the crucial, immediate psychological lift that you need to continue working toward the larger, previously unbearable task. It transforms hopelessness into a pathway of manageable steps.
We have to now venture into the deepest psychological waters, the dark side of extreme isolation, where the boundaries of reality begin to blur due to chronic sleep and effort deprivation.
This is where we examine the cautionary tales of hallucinations and, in the worst case, psychosis. The most famous and most tragic example for this race is Donald Crowhurst from the original 1968 Golden Globe.
Crowhurst's mental trajectory is just terrifying because it illustrates the endpoint of that vicious cycle we discussed earlier. He couldn't cope with the immense pressure and the strain of competition, so he started faking his logbook.
Which compounded his internal struggle with this overwhelming guilt. His psychological state just deteriorated into a full-blown psychosis.
His final diary entries are hard to read.
They are. They show him slipping into this state of grandiosity, believing he was transcending human life, elevating himself to the level of God. He believed that by becoming divine, he could take his own life without it being a failure, as his existence would be purely symbolic.
His boat was found abandoned, along with these meticulous, detailed notebooks just detailing the complete disintegration of his mind. It's the extreme consequence of total cognitive resource depletion.
It is. Yet the line between that kind of psychosis and a more benign, exhaustion-induced hallucination can be surprisingly thin. We have the example of Joshua Slocum, the very first solo circumnavigator.
Right, his story's very different.
Slocum, completely exhausted in the Southern Ocean, he wrote of hallucinating that the pilot of Columbus's ship, the Pinta, appeared on his deck and took the helm, steering the vessel for him.
And this hallucination wasn't terrifying for him. It was comforting.
It was a relief. It provided the assurance that the boat was being cared for, and that allowed him to get some much-needed rest.
And Mark Slatz, during his extreme rowing venture, pushed effort and sleep deprivation so far that he experienced hallucinations for a week and a half.
Which shows that the physiological strain of extreme endurance alone, even without the pressure of cheating or logbook fraud, can lead to a kind of transient psychosis. A GGR sailor has to recognize the early signs of mental fatigue, the auditory tricks, the inability to focus, and immediately prioritize rest, using every trick we've discussed to pull back from that precipice.
Another fundamental aspect of the solo experience is the acute perception of the boat as a closed system. This requires a profound mental shift.
Ellen MacArthur, after his record-breaking circumnavigation, she provided such a powerful insight into this. At sea, the boat is your entire world. And what you took with you, your food, your fuel, spare parts, medical supplies, is absolutely finite.
You can't call a store. Nothing more is available.
Nothing. And this intense, acute perception of limited resources governs all of your decision-making.
She noted that upon returning to shore, this deep understanding of the finite nature of her vessel immediately transposed itself into a profound understanding of global resource depletion and the global economy.
It connects the micro world of the small boat to the macro world of the planet. And this awareness reinforces the necessity of obsessive due diligence, the constant daily checks and maintenance, because every breakage, every spent resource is permanent until you reach the finish line.
So anxiety over breakages is mitigated not by hoping for the best,
but by the ritual of constant proactive care and maintenance.
So moving to the return to shore, the transition is jarring. After months of this intense internal focus, the immediate psychological need for social interaction is immense.
Sailors often experience this massive surge of adrenaline and a need to externalize all the experiences they've been internalizing for months. Mark Slatz recounted that after he finished his row, he talked continuously for 2 days straight with his friends.
Couldn't sleep.
He was driven solely by the need to communicate and share the stories that had been locked inside his head.
And this intense outward release is often followed by a period of severe emotional draining.
Yes. The adrenaline rush that sustained you during crises, that takes a significant amount of time to dissipate. And it often results in severe post-voyage insomnia and just general trouble winding down. The body doesn't have an off switch.
The consensus among successful circumnavigators is that the experience changes you profoundly. You come back, not the same.
Jean-Luc Vandenheed noted that the voyage instills a sort of fatalism. Things that seemed overwhelmingly important before the race now have dramatically less significance. Your priorities are just fundamentally recalibrated by the experience.
For those sailors who face the crushing heartbreak of being rescued and losing their vessel, the psychological aftermath is particularly intense. We should give this moment the gravity it deserves.
We should. The boat, after months of isolation, it's not merely a piece of equipment. It becomes a friend, a home, the sole arbiter of your survival.
When Ian Herbert Jones was rescued after being dismasted in the sunny ocean, he described the experience of having to cut the lines to his vessel and watching his friend, which represented 4 years of his life and his safety, just drift away.
That is described as an awful and gut-wrenching emotional low point. It's the definitive end of the adventure, but it's coupled with the trauma of letting go of the one object that provided you safety and sustained your entire psychological journey. That trauma demands significant recognition and time for processing when you get home.
The commitment is so deep that the vessel becomes an extension of the self.
Losing the boat feels like a physical and emotional amputation. And this is why the preparation, the emotional regulation techniques, the mental armor we've discussed, it's all so critical. They are the psychological foundations upon which the entire experience rests.
So this deep dive has really distilled the psychological roadmap for the GGR 2026 sailor. We've covered the necessity of total commitment and ruthless reality checking to prevent that sunk cost blindness from derailing you before you even begin.
Second, we emphasize that managing your continuous cognitive engagement and your chronic fatigue is absolutely non-negotiable. Fatigue dictates your emotional stability and your susceptibility to cognitive traps, like systematic processing when your anxiety spikes.
And third, we reviewed the active regulatory techniques that are necessary for a crisis. Situation modification for preparation, attentional deployment in the moment to conserve energy, and goal decomposition to transform a catastrophic setback into a sequence of manageable, achievable tasks.
The isolation is the ultimate test. It really is. It's the internal experiment that pushes the mind to its absolute limits, forcing you to find resources you never even knew you possessed.
You have to remember the words of Jean-Luc Vandenheide. The initial goal may be to win, but the ultimate success, his primary focus throughout the later stages of his race, was simply to arrive.
And this leaves us with a final thought for you to mull over as you continue your preparations. When you were out there, months into the race, deep in the Southern Ocean, and a major crisis hits, what internal shift, what precise moment of mental calculation must a sailor achieve to consciously prioritize survival and arrival over that initial 100% commitment to winning?
When does the competitor die so the survivor can live, and how do you ensure that switch is ready to be flipped?